That's Laurie Anderson with Language is a Virus. Language is certainly central to her musical art form. Lynn Malcolm with you, and today on All in the Mind, we explore new research that suggests that language is so powerful that it actually changes the way we think. But I couldn't find you. I couldn't find you. Lera Boroditsky is Assistant Professor of Psychology at Stanford University. She's intrigued by the controversial question of whether the language we speak shapes our cognition and therefore our behaviour.
Certainly the history of thinking on this question goes back thousands of years. Charlemagne, Holy Roman Emperor, said to have a second language is to have a second soul. I think Charles V, one of his successors, said a man who knows four languages is worth four men. But on the other side, people have also expressed pretty strong ideas. So Shakespeare famously has Juliet say, "What's in a name? A rose by any other name would smell as sweet." So people have been thinking about this question of the relationship between language and thought, the extent to which what we call things, how we talk, changes the way we see the world, changes our reality for a long time. But there hasn't really been a lot of evidence one way or the other.
And it's this empirical evidence that Lera Boroditsky is working on at Stanford University. The idea that language shapes thought is historically quite controversial, as it goes against the belief that human cognition is universal and not determined by language or culture.
In the 70s, Noam Chomsky, a very important linguist, pioneered a theory, an idea, that all human languages might actually underneath be essentially the same, that there might be a universal grammar that underlies all the 7,000-some languages that people speak around the world. Now, this was proposed as a possibility, as a hypothetical idea, that there could be a formalism that describes all the languages and makes them underneath the same. If you believe that idea, if you believe that hypothesis, then asking how different languages shape the way we think is not a question that even makes sense, because if all languages are really the same underneath, then why would you even bother asking how a speaker of French as opposed to a speaker of Mandarin might think differently? The languages should all give people the same thoughts. But if it turns out that languages aren't really psychologically the same underneath, then that reopens the question and allows us to ask, if you speak Spanish or if you speak Mandarin or if you speak Kuktai or Wikmunkan, do the structures of those languages, the habits in those languages, actually shape the way you see the world?
One of the ways Lera Boroditsky has set out to test how language may shape our thoughts is by looking at how different language speakers think about the abstract concepts of time and space.
And it turns out that people around the world think about time in all kinds of cool and different ways, depending on the patterns in their language and culture. So the first things we looked at are differences in metaphors people have for time. So for example, in English, we often use spatial terms like ahead, forward, behind, back to talk about time. So we'll say the best is ahead of us, the worst is behind us. We're treating time as if it were a horizontal path that we travel. But in other languages, in addition to horizontal terms, they're also vertical terms. So in Mandarin, for example, the words up and down are used to talk about time. The past is said to be up and the future is down. And we wondered, does this matter for how people lay out time in the privacy of their minds when they're imagining a timeline, when they're thinking about arranging their schedule? Are Mandarin speakers more likely to imagine a vertical timeline than are English speakers? And that turns out to be the case. And there are other differences that I think are even more cool. So Rafael Nunez and Yves Sweetser did some work with the Aymara. This is an Andean language. And the Aymara, instead of putting the future ahead and the past behind, the way we do in English, they do it in exactly the reverse direction. So for them, the past is in front of them and the future is behind them. When they're talking about the past, they'll point ahead. And when they're talking about the future, they'll point behind them. And that seems incredibly counterintuitive to English speakers.
Can you give me an example of some of the cognitive research to support this, that people actually think differently?
Sure. Let me give you an example from English and Mandarin. This is a very simple experiment. If you just stand next to someone and you pick a spot right in front of them and say, imagine this is today, where would you put yesterday and where would you put tomorrow? And just let people point wherever it is they think yesterday and tomorrow go in relation to today. What you'll see is English speakers will almost always arrange yesterday, today, and tomorrow in a horizontal line, whereas Mandarin speakers will arrange time horizontally some of the time, but they'll also often make vertical arrangements. So they'll put yesterday above and tomorrow below. Another feature of language that seems to matter for how people think about time is writing direction. So if your language is written from left to right, like English is, you're going to be likely to arrange time from left to right. Whereas if it's written from right to left, like Hebrew or Arabic, then you're going to go in exactly the opposite direction and arrange time going from right to left. So yesterday will go on the right and tomorrow will go on the left. One thing that we got interested in is what happens if your language doesn't arrange space with respect to your body. So in all of the examples I've given you, people use their spatial knowledge to arrange time. Well, what if your spatial knowledge is completely different to begin with? How would you think about time then? And so I had a chance to work with Alice Gaby. She's a linguist in Melbourne who has studied Kuuk-Thaayorre. This is a language spoken in Pohnpeorau on Cape York in Australia. And what's so cool about Kuuk-Thaayorre is that instead of terms like left and right to organize space, the Kuuk-Thaayorre predominantly use terms like north, south, east, and west. So everything in the language is arranged in terms of these cardinal directions. Now, when I say everything, I mean really everything at every scale. A famous example might be you say, there's an ant on your southwest leg, or move the cup to the north, northeast a little bit. And this is a completely different system from what we've seen anywhere else.
And it would be quite challenging, well, for someone like me who has a terrible sense of direction. I'm not sure that I'd operate very well in that world at all.
Well, this is the thing about language, is it is a socially enforced and practiced skill, right? So in Kuuk-Thaayorre, the way you say hi is you say, which way are you going? And the answer should be something like north, northwest, in the far distance. How about you? And so Alice and I wondered, how would the Kuuk-Thaayorre arrange time if they don't use the ideas of left and right to think about space? How would they think about time?
A word of warning here that the music you're about to hear may include the voices of people who have died.
We're going to sing this song about the clock. Me and my brother, Sir William. My name is Donald William.
Linguist Alice Gaby has been working with the Pohnpeorau community in Cape York Peninsula on several of their languages. She describes the exercises she and Lera Boroditsky asked the Kuuk-Thaayorre speakers to complete.
We developed a set of pictures. So one set would have a picture of a whole banana, and then another picture where the banana's been slightly peeled, another picture where a bite's been taken off the top of the banana, another picture where the banana's been mostly eaten, and then finally a picture of the empty banana skin. So we would ask them to lay them out from first to last. An English speaker would put the picture of the whole banana to their left, and then the banana that's been slightly peeled just right of that, and continuing all the way along till at the rightmost end they'd have the picture of the empty banana skin. So because of our language and also our habits of literacy, the English speakers are trying to show a temporal relationship across the left to right axis. So the earliest banana on their left, the latest banana on their right. Now, if we give this same set of cards to a speaker of Kuuk-Thaayorre in Pohnpeorau, we found that they were tending to show the full banana at the east and the empty banana to the west, with all the intermediate stages flowing from east to west. So it's quite a different mode of representation.
So how do you think that actually influences the way people in this community think and therefore behave differently to, say, English speakers do?
Well, I think people in Pomparau who are speaking traditional languages like Kuktaur and Wikmunkan are very attuned to the cardinal directions, north, south, east, west. So just to say hello to someone in Pomparau, you ask, which roughly translates as, where are you going? Or, where are you coming from? Now, if you're saying that to everyone you encounter in the street and then having to answer with, you know, I'm coming from a little way to the southwest, or I'm headed northeast, you're constantly having to pay attention to what direction you're moving in, what direction objects in your world are located in with respect to one another. And when you're constantly attuned to your environment in that way, you tend to use those terms even more. So if we were walking along and I happened to see a snake that you're about to step on, I would be most likely as an English speaker to yell out to you, there's a snake on your right, or there's a snake just in front of you, and you'd know which way to jump. Now, if I were to yell out to you, there's a snake to your southwest, would you be able to jump in the right direction very fast? And I'd say as an English speaker, probably not, because we're not always sensitive to where we are facing with respect to north, south, east and west. Our reaction time in making those judgments is that much slower. Whereas in Pomparau, I think I wouldn't get ethics approval to test this by throwing snakes at people, but my prediction would be that people would jump a whole lot faster than an English speaker would.
Linguist Alice Gaby from Monash University in Melbourne. You're with All in the Mind on RN, Radio Australia and online. Lynn Malcolm with you, and we're exploring how the language we speak shapes the way we think. And anyone who has learnt languages other than English will be familiar with the differences in the grammatical rules concerning the gender of nouns. It's essential to learn the gender of words if you want to speak the language correctly. This particularly interested Lera Boroditsky.
I started out looking at the gender of words because I thought this would be a particularly arbitrary way for a language to influence thought, because grammatical gender is largely arbitrary, and it just seems so silly to think of a table as masculine or feminine. You know, what would that even mean? If language can even affect thinking in this way, then it must be a really powerful tool for shaping thought. Some of the first work on this was actually done by Roman Jakobson. He's a Russian linguist, and he asked students at Moscow University to personify different days of the week. Different days of the week have different genders in Russian, and what he noticed is when people were personifying Monday, they were trying to act like Monday, they would act like a man, but if they were acting like Wednesday, they would act like a woman. And Monday is grammatically masculine in Russian, and Wednesday is grammatically feminine. And so this is some of the first observations that there might be something to this idea that the grammatical genders of words actually influence how people think about those objects. Mm. One of my favorite examples comes from art. So a student and I looked at how artists portray abstract entities like death or time or virtue in their paintings and sculptures. So we looked at a really large database of art and looked at all personifications and allegories in the database. And we found that about 78% of the time, the grammatical gender of the noun in the artist's native language predicted whether death was going to be a man or a woman, or whether time was going to be a man or a woman in the work of art.
So is it likely that that is going to influence how people behave in the end, or does it make a difference?
Well, that's an excellent question. There are different ways that languages influence us. Let me give you an example that I think has immediate real-world consequences. Languages differ in how they describe causal events, and let's talk about accidents in particular. In English, we don't make a very strong distinction between an accidental event and an intentional event. So if I break a cup accidentally, or if I grab it in anger and smash it on the ground, in both cases it's fine to say she broke the cup. But in some languages, if it's an accident, you would use a different grammatical form. You would say the cup broke, or the cup broke itself, or to her it happened that the cup broke, or something like that. So you would distinguish that event as being an accident in the grammatical form. So one thing that we wondered was whether speakers who speak such languages that really more strongly distinguish accidents from intentional actions pay attention to events differently. So we compared the speakers of English, Spanish, and Japanese. And Spanish and Japanese, of course, are very different from one another, but they both differ from English in that they differentiate accidents from intentional actions more strongly than English does. And what we did is we showed everyone videos of accidents and videos of intentional actions. And there were simple actions, like someone popped the balloon and it was either intentional or accidental. We asked one group of people to describe the videos to make sure that the differences between languages were real, and they were. And we asked another group of people just to watch the videos and try to remember them. And later we tested their memory. What we found in the descriptions was English speakers were much more likely to mention the agent when describing an accident than were speakers of Japanese or Spanish. So if someone accidentally popped the balloon, English speakers would still say, "He popped the balloon," where speakers of Spanish or Japanese might not mention the agent. When we looked at the memory results, we saw a pattern that mirrored the language data. So what we saw is that English speakers remembered really well when someone intentionally popped the balloon, and they also remembered really well, equally well, when someone accidentally popped the balloon. It didn't matter to them whether the action was intentional or accidental. They remembered who did it. For Spanish and Japanese speakers, they remembered who did it really well when it was an intentional action, but less well when it was an accident. So when it was an accident, if they were describing it, they weren't likely to mention the agent, and they also weren't paying attention to who the person was as much. They were distributing their attention elsewhere. So that to me is an example of a cross-linguistic difference with important real-world consequences. Of course, we want to think about how we blame people, how we distribute punishment, how we participate in eyewitness testimony, and what kinds of elements of our culture or our language are contributing to our judgments. To what extent do we maybe judge people too harshly because of the structure of our language? Or to what extent do other people maybe avoid responsibility because of the structure of their language, and so on? There are no right answers to these questions, but they lead us to think about how we come to make these important judgments about other people.
Yes, this insight into the way we choose our words and language structures is potentially very powerful. To what extent can it be really influential in legal courtroom situations, for example?
There are really interesting cases that already exist, case studies of translation, for example, in the courtroom. So one example comes from the work of Dan Slobin. He cites a case where a Spanish-speaking defendant is giving testimony, and the defendant says, in Spanish, "I was holding her," his girlfriend, "at the top of the stairs, and then to me, it happened that she fell," essentially. The way this is translated for the English-speaking court is, "I was holding her and then I dropped her down the stairs." That has a very different feeling than the original Spanish. Mm-hmm. And it raises questions about what would even be the correct way to translate that. This is an example of where simple question about the relationship between language and thought is actually being adjudicated in court. Yeah. For me, this is an empirical question, something that we should adjudicate in the lab.
Very difficult to do, though.
Yeah, these are very hard questions, and they connect with many standing controversies about the nature of mind and the nature of language. And they are very important questions about how we come to be the way that we are and why do we think the things that we think.
And it even seems that the extent to which we blame others for their actions can come down to the language used. Do you remember the scandalous incident between Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson?
So we used the original wardrobe malfunction. This is when Justin Timberlake and Janet Jackson performed at the Super Bowl halftime show. And there was an incident where Janet Jackson's breast became exposed. Now, everyone in the United States has seen this video, and there was a lot of outrage about it at the time. Mm. And so what we wanted to see is whether describing this situation in slightly different ways would lead people to blame Justin Timberlake more or less for the event and want to fine him more or less money. So we made everyone watch the video again, and we gave them either an agentive description where we said, in the final dance move, he reached across her body and he ripped the costume, or in the final dance move, he reached across her body and the costume ripped. Of course, everyone saw exactly what happened, so they saw the actual visual reality. But what we found was that people who got the agentive description not only blamed Justin Timberlake more, they also wanted to charge him 53% more in fines. And that was something on the order of $36,000 more in terms of what people wanted from him as a punitive fine. We thought that was a really expensive agentive expression.
Absolutely.
You know, just one transitive verb costs you thousands of dollars. That's one of my favorite recent examples where a small change in phrasing can lead to a big difference in people's judgments.
The other structure that you talk about is the use of metaphor. How powerful are metaphors, and how do they figure in the way we reason?
Metaphors are a wonderful tool and a dangerous tool for thinking. So I think about metaphor a lot in the context of reasoning about social issues or political issues. How does a regular person think about how to deal with a societal problem like diminishing crime or bettering the economy or decreasing unemployment? How do we think about these really complex systems? One way we do it is by employing metaphors. Metaphors invite us to think about these complex or abstract things in terms of things that we already know something about. So you might say, crime is a beast attacking our cities. Well, we know something about beasts, and we know something about what it means for a beast to attack. And all of a sudden, you have all of this conceptual structure, all this knowledge that you already have in your mind that you can apply to think about crime. And this can lead you then to make decisions and reason along the lines of that metaphor and come to a conclusion about how crime should be dealt with. But of course, we have not one metaphor, but many metaphors for any given abstract idea. So we talk about crime not just as a beast attacking, but also as a virus infecting or plaguing our cities. And it turns out that depending on which metaphor you choose, you end up thinking that very different kinds of solutions would be effective in addressing the problem of crime. So if we give people an example where we say crime is a virus ravaging the city, they propose that what should be done is we should investigate the root of the problems, and we should essentially do things to inoculate the city against further infection. So they say you should improve the education system, or you should work on unemployment. These are very systemic, reform-oriented solutions. But if we tell people crime is a beast ravaging the city and give them all the same statistics and numbers as before, they now instead say what you need to do is you need to make more jails and you need to put out more police officers and give harsher sentences and more punishment. So they give enforcement and punishment solutions that are more in line with how you would deal with a beast. In our studies, we found that these metaphors are surprisingly powerful. So a single word difference in a description of a city's crime problem can lead to a difference in opinion between people that's at least as big as the difference in opinion between Democrats and Republicans, for example, in U.S. politics, which is a very big, ecologically big difference.
Mm. And politicians and advertisers seem to know this, mm-hmm. but do you think that they realise the true power of the language they use, that according to your work, they are actually changing the way people think?
I think often what psychologists study in the lab is formalised things that master practitioners already know. So one of my former colleagues at Stanford, Amos Tversky, who did work with Daniel Kahneman that won the Nobel Prize in Economics, said the only things we do are things that used car salesmen already know. We're just formalizing that. And I think that's true in this case. Politicians, lawyers, lobbyists, advertisers know the power of language. What we're doing in the lab is understanding the mechanisms through which language shapes thought and understanding under what circumstances it works and under what circumstances it doesn't, because it's not the case that any metaphor will have desired effects. And very often, politicians change language in ways that is completely ineffectual or even silly.
Can we just now go back to the way your ideas differ from Noam Chomsky? And if you're right, what could this mean for language teaching and language learning?
So my approach to language is very empirical and psychological based. My question is, do languages differ in a way that actually is reflected in psychology and in behavior? And the results from my lab and from many other labs around the world say yes, that at least in psychological terms, languages are really different. They invite different mental practices. They invite us to see the world in different ways. Each language comes with its own cognitive toolkit, almost like each language is a little parallel universe that sees the world a little bit differently. I think one important thing to take away from that is how much we lose when we lose a language. So we're losing languages at an alarming rate right now. Some people estimate we're losing one language every 2 weeks. Considering how many different structures, how many different worldviews are embedded in every language, and how little we know about the languages of the world to date, that's a tremendous loss. It's a tremendous cultural loss. So one important takeaway, I think, from this work is to try to focus on language revitalization and to think about how we can preserve this incredible cultural treasure that's been crafted in language communities over many, many generations. What can we do to keep it alive?
Lera Boroditsky. And as linguist Alice Gaby knows only too well, many Australian Indigenous languages have already been lost, and few are being learnt by children. But she is optimistic because some groups are showing extraordinary commitment to reviving their languages. And if you'd like to hear more about Alice Gaby's work with the Indigenous languages, go to the All in the Mind website for more of the interview I did with her. Now, let's hear again from Alice Gaby and Lera Boroditsky on how language influences thought.
The sort of caricature of the idea that language shapes thought is that people who believe this think of language as a straitjacket, or they believe the language you speak will determine how you think and who you are and how you behave, which I would argue is not at all the case. What we're starting to get a richer picture of is of these habits of the way we use language changing the way we tend to think. But of course, we can change the way we use language.
You can learn a tremendous amount by learning another language. Of course, you can speak that language. You can communicate with folks who speak that language. You can read literature. You can order off the menu. You can pick up that attractive stranger in the piazza. But you also get an in into another worldview, into another way of seeing the world. And that, coming back to Charlemagne, can be kind of like having a second soul, having a second perspective on the world. That could be very enriching.
Lera Boroditsky, Assistant Professor in Psychology at Stanford University. And you also heard Dr. Alice Gaby, linguist from Monash University in Melbourne. Our sound engineer today is Andrei Shabanov. Visit the program's website at abc.net.au/radionational and choose All in the Mind in the drop-down list. There you'll find photographs and extra audio from my interview with Alice Gaby about Indigenous languages. I'd love to hear your thoughts on language too, so leave a comment while you're there and catch up on past programs as well. Last week's show on the bilingual brain may be of interest to you if you missed it. See you on Facebook and Twitter too. Thanks for joining me today. I'm Lynn Malcolm. Catch you next week. Language, it's a virus.